Welcome back, readers and romance seekers, to Hopelessly Romantic Behind the Page. I hope we had a very lovely Halloween evening last weekend with just as much candy and celebration as your heart desired. I certainly had a lovely time, and Beauty and the Werewolf by Mercedes Lackey was just the right thing that I needed to get me into the Halloween-y mood. So I gotta get into first things first. I have to talk about the rating that I give, that piddly 2 out of 5 stars. This hurt. It hurt me in my soul. If there was any proof whatsoever that I am in fact trying to be as objective as possible with these reviews, it would have been that episode. Because I love this author. Mercedes Lackey has definitely become one of my top favorites. And I loved reading this book. But I still had to approach this from a romance perspective. This is a romance novel review podcast. And it wasn't from a fantasy perspective. It wasn't from a fairy tale retelling perspective. It's a fine entry for the latter two categories, but with the former, that romance, it falls very, very, very flat. I really couldn't deny it. I actually told myself, like, I could maybe make it a 3 out of 5, but no, it maybe a 2.5. I don't really do points, I suppose. Because again, those last few categories, they're kind of arbitrary in the way that they add up to the final rating. Like, you know, the realism rating. That was a 1 out of 5 because this is a fantasy story, and it's not fair to include that quote unquote in all of the stars, so to speak. So it's not really fair to use that. So if I have a book 5.5 or 5 out of 5 stars, but the realism rating is like a 2, it's like, you know, it reflects how I think that it fell into the romance aspect. Beauty and the Werewolf doesn't even twist around the idea of lovers to enemies, if we're going to look at maybe one very famous type of romantic trope. I can easily see that concept popping in, though. I almost kind of saw it a little bit happening with Eric and Bella, but I feel like that might have been something to kind of put us off our guard, so to speak. But with Sebastian, he wasn't really an enemy of hers. He was just, unfortunately, just as much of a victim of circumstance as she was. I could see a scenario where Sebastian and Bella had met at maybe a number of high society functions, something that I don't really consider that far-fetched, because her father had the king's ear and was held in high regard in the courts. And in those few moments, maybe caught between each of these society functions, Bella might have mistaken his quiet demeanor for snobbishness, maybe, and they can banter away like an Austen novel. So when she gets stuck with him because of the werewolf bite, it is very much to her dismay, but now she gets the opportunity to know Sebastian better, and she can learn that there is more beneath the beast. I do find it interesting that this was a version of Beauty and the Beast where the beast in question was only so for maybe 3 nights out of the month. Any other retelling would keep the beast transformed 100% of the time, with maybe an emotional moment or two of possible human shape just to pull at the heartstrings. Like maybe perhaps there is a fraught dream experience from the point of view of the beauty in question, and they might see the beast now transformed as human, but they don't really know that it is the beast, so they have to figure out what is going on, and maybe the person could be like trying to guide them, or maybe it's even the person who might have cursed our beast. We never know. So that's one idea. But I wasn't so surprised by the ending, with Sebastian's curse remaining upon him. It did get me a little when his change would overcome him every night, instead of being bound by the moon. And, of course, we can't have a Beauty and the Beast story without the transformation power of love, as we see with Bella using the wolf to give way to the man, so that Sebastian may be himself, whether covered in fur or clothing. I have been noticing a trend, however small, where these Beauty and the Beast stories end without a transformation, even if a curse is lifted, and it certainly shows a changing attitude in our collective culture. Let's look at this one for a little bit. We have Sebastian. He is human for most of the time, but he keeps his curse at the end of the story. So why does he not have a full 100% of the time beast form? I kind of think that this is because of the limitations of the Luna imprint. I don't know if Mercedes Lackey was commissioned for this piece by Luna and if they had constraints. So when we have, let's say, a run-of-the-mill romance, it's a little questionable when the beau in concept, I suppose, isn't necessarily human. It might cross a couple of lines that Harlequin, as genteel as it is now that I'm discovering, might not want to really toe that much. I'm sure there are other versions out there somewhere that I simply haven't found of a Beauty and the Beast story, where it's very much like this. It's a transformation that overcomes him rather than a 100% of the time, I'm always a beast. I think it's really interesting, and I'm wondering how much of it was the author's design and how much of it was, let's say, the publisher's requirement for the story. Now, when we look at these greater themes, I suppose, there's a version of Beauty and the Beast in nearly every culture in the world. From what I understand, Beast stories are a sort of way to address a fear that a lot of women had, a fear of becoming married, at least from their own perspective. We need to remember that marrying for love is a relatively new concept. And if a woman is getting married, it's because someone told her to do it. It wasn't necessarily her idea. She might have had input, but other than that, probably she really didn't have anything to say about it. So what better way to console these young women than with a story that promises a potentially better future? Your new husband may seem like an ugly monster now, but if you're faithful, you're kind, and you do what you're told, you will grow to love them, and they may not seem so beastly afterwards. A good barometer, I think, for cultural opinions is who has the biggest story arc in a retelling of Beauty and the Beast. Is it Beauty or is it the Beast? In the days of old, it would be Beauty, because she had to learn to love someone who was conceivably, possibly, unlovable. Probably the most famous example of the Beast with the stronger story arc would be Disney's original animated film from the 90s. Here, in Beauty and the Werewolf, it seems that Bella has the larger arc, mostly because she's done the most growth, in my opinion. She's angry about her circumstances, but doesn't sit around wallowing in her fate, and she has like a lot of realizations and a lot of growth. She comes into new skills, comes into her power as a sorceress, and begins to believe that she might actually fall in love when she originally thought she would end up a spinster. Because remember, she was training with the granny to become a granny herself. That was going to be a perhaps a very lonely life when we think about it. She was just gonna say, yep, no, my stepsisters will get married, my stepmother doesn't worry about me too much, my father will be all right with this, I'm just gonna go be a witch in the woods. She does kind of end up becoming a sorceress or a witch, really, depending on the way you're looking at it. But, you know, now she gets to have a pretty handsome duke as her husband while she does it. Sebastian does have his own growth as well, mainly to gain some self-confidence, but I don't think his arc is as big as Bella's. It is a dramatic arc, though. He's almost given up hope and resigned himself to his fate, but with Bella's help, he comes safe enough, he can feel safe enough that he can come to himself again, especially in his wolf form. The ending pretty much says that all the way. Bella is like, hey, I love you very much. Please don't be an angry wolfman. He's like, okay, I won't be an angry wolfman because you love me. Yay. I guess there's some, I don't know, I hate to use the word problematic, but it's questionable, I think. He's like, you don't have to love somebody for them to change, but, you know, it helps sometimes, maybe. I don't know. I'm not a psychologist. I am not a relationship counselor. Do not take my advice. And I can also talk about the trend of women preferring their beasts untransformed, but then we'd be here all day. Sebastian, again, being another example. Not only was his curse not lifted, it got harder. Instead of only 3 nights out of the month, it is every night. Oh boy. Shifting gears for a moment, finding information on the Luna imprint is hard. Come to think of it, finding information on any defunct Harlequin imprint is hard, at least for my amateur investigation skills. And by amateur investigation skills, I mean I type things into Google and dig maybe past the first page results. There are so many different imprints that have changed, like they shift and change, like Western romance was once American romance, and they're all kind of like amorphous, is that the right word? But they've been at this game for a very long time, Harlequin has, and their imprints have changed so much, so there's probably just a lot that got lost to the ether. Information is out there. I managed to track a little bit down, but nothing solid enough for my taste. I wish I could find, like, stats, you know? I want to know how many books were sold or how many authors they hosted. I'm sure it exists in their database somewhere, but until they invite me to poke around into their resource library and Canada lets the Americans back in again, my primitive Google skills will have to suffice. So this particular find, Beauty and the Werewolf, was pretty lucky as far as finding goes. If I want any of the older books from now defunct imprints, I'm going to have to start looking at garage sales or estate sales, maybe even one of those library sales where they're just like, hey, we've got a lot of books that nobody's checking out, please come get them. But if I want to find these books from those forgotten imprints, I'm going to have to really start digging. There is one which I have a lot of interest in acquiring, but Harlequin doesn't sell any version of the book, electronic or otherwise, and any physical copies that I can find are going for a stupidly high price for such a tiny romance novel from the 80s. So, if anyone knows where I can find a copy of The Runaway Heart by Claire Richmond, a physical copy, please email me. I would be ever so grateful. On that note, let's get into what I have been reading this week. And honestly, it's a whole lot of nothing. Hey, I can't be perfect all the time. I was out of town last weekend for a wedding, and the Animal Crossing update is coming up this weekend, so I have been running around on planes and putting out fires on my little island, leaving very little time for actual reading. Before you ask, I was not reading on the plane like a normal person. I was playing Animal Crossing like a nerd. But lest that I leave you wanting, I'm going to go ahead and share with you some of my favorite fairy tale retelling novels. It is a bit of a list, and it's not even a fraction of the full collection from my bookshelf, so buckle up. First, I'm going to start with a novel and a writer that has really sparked my love for the fairy tale retelling, Robin McKinley. I've been reading her for quite a few years, beginning in late middle school or early high school, depending on how you see that. Her first novel that I read was Beauty. For me, this is the one that started it all. It's for our younger readers, and even though it was published in 1978, it's still an enchanting read today. I would say that it's the most straightforward out of all of the retellings that I've got on the list. If you're familiar with the original Beauty and the Beast story, this is an excellent expansion on the story that you love. And even though it's for a younger audience, my copy is much loved and worn, and something that I love returning to over and over again. There's something about the simplicity of this story that just, it's like, you know, it's like tomato soup with grilled cheese. It's just comfort food. It's wonderful. So we're going to stick with McKinley for a little bit longer. So next I will talk about Rose Daughter. Now, if you've grown up with McKinley's Beauty like I had, you might fall in love with her second version of Beauty and the Beast. I think it is perfectly poised to enchant readers of beauty, enticing you with beautiful prose and wordplay. It's a more mature story than Beauty was. By that I mean the circumstances are a lot more complicated, and there's a lot more at play going on in the spell, so to speak. But it is a delightful story nonetheless. Now, if you're interested in a novel that explores the themes of Beauty and the Beast, but without being a full retelling, I might direct your interest to Sunshine. I wasn't originally keen on this novel for McKinley, since it featured vampires and a post-post-apocalyptic setting. Post-post-apocalyptic basically describes a world that has gotten over its horrible, horrible apocalypse crisis and started to actually fix a few things up a little bit. It's not my typical fare, but there's a quote on the front cover featuring, or from Neil Gaiman, that said, "Pretty much perfect," and that gave me everything I needed to bring this one home. And honestly, having Neil Gaiman put something called pretty much perfect on any novel that I could have potentially written, let's just say that's hashtag goals. I would slot Sunshine into the paranormal genre rather than fantasy, and I'm not sure that I'd label it as romance, but you might have to be the judge for yourself. Last but not least for McKinley is Spindle's End. This is a Sleeping Beauty retelling that mixes new themes alongside the traditional tale. I'm not going to say much more else about it, only that it has surprising twists and turns, but still follows a familiar path. It is one of my favorites from her, and one that I keep revisiting. Next up is one that you've probably heard of, Ella Enchanted by Gail Carson Levine. You might know it by the film of the same name, but if that's the only thing you know about it, that is a real shame. The YouTuber Dominic Noble does an adaptation series on his YouTube channel. Basically, what he does is he looks at the book, and then he looks at its adapted film. And if you're really interested in the differences, I highly recommend watching that, because he calls Ella Enchanted adaptation in name only. And that's pretty accurate. The film is terrible, and it has nothing to do with this charming approach to the Cinderella story. In this book, Ella is given the gift of obedience, and gift is in huge air quotes here, because while the fairy that did it thinks it's a marvelous attribute, Ella's life is shackled by it. After one misery too many, Ella sets out to free herself from the curse and live a normal life. This is another one for the young readers, but I think it's still worth the look. Now, if you are a Disney fan, the next two are for you. First up is Fairest of All by Serena Valentino. This sparked off a series of books that watched the stories from the Disney films, but from the villain's perspective. Or at least a version of the tale where the villain was more than what they seemed. This story follows the evil queen from Snow White, and how she transformed from a gentle stepmother into the witch we all know. It's a sad tale, but one that you might enjoy if you preferred your villains with more dimension. Then we have As Old as Time by Liz Braswell. This comes from the Twisted Tales series that takes a what-if approach to their stories. Here, our what-if explores the idea of the sorceress. Perhaps she was Belle's mother, and why had she done what she did? And what can our fair Belle do about it? I have a few of these books on my shelf, but this one might be one of my favorites, behind Reflection, a what-if tale surrounding Mulan and Shang. Finally, I will leave you with not a fairy tale retelling, but a retelling of an old familiar classic. The Graveyard Book by Neil Gaiman is his approach to The Jungle Book by Rudyard Kipling. It is a dark and grim story, but it hits all of the same familiar beats from the original concept. Gaiman is an excellent writer, and I cannot say enough good things about his work. I highly recommend you check The Graveyard Book out. So with all of that to chew on, I will leave us here for today. I'll see you next week when we read The Horse Trainer Secret by Allison Lee. Thank you so much for joining me, readers and romance seekers, and I hope to see you once again for Hopelessly Romantic. If you like the show, please visit us at hopelesslyromanticpodcast.com for more. If you have questions or want to recommend a read, please email us at contact@hopelesslyromanticpodcast.com. Also, please leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. It will go a long way to help the show out, and that way I can keep bringing you lots of fun episodes. The show is written and produced by me, Heather Songster. Our technical advisor is Kwang Hin Cho, and Hopelessly Romantic is an H with K production. And it doesn't matter what you read, only that it's what you love.